Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the museum. I'm Melissa Shine, Director of Public Programs. Does anyone like deli in this room? We are pleased to welcome you to the museum tonight for a conversation between David Sacks and food maven Arthur Schwartz. In a quest to save the endangered deli, Sacks toured the world interviewing deli owners and famous deli lovers like Ed Koch, Ruth Reichel, and Mel Brooks, cutting sandwiches at Katz's and voyaging to New York, LA, Montreal, Paris, London, and Poland. David Sacks is a journalist who has contributed to New York Magazine, Vanity Fair, GQ, Portfolio, Rolling Stone, and other publications. And Save the Deli is what the Los Angeles Times calls a deeply satisfying book. Arthur Schwartz is acknowledged as one of the country's foremost experts on food, cooking, culinary history, restaurants, and restaurant history. He was the restaurant critic and executive food editor of the New York Daily News for 18 years and has published several cookbooks. We have one for sale.
Seven.
Including Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking, Yiddish Recipes Revisited, which I've used some recipes from, and the Southern Italian Table, Authentic Taste from Traditional Kitchens. And I think you said you take a group to Italy every fall, right?
No, I actually go several times a year.
Several times a year?
I have a cooking school just south of the Amalfi Coast.
Anyone who wants to join him in the fall.
I have a former student here who can fill you in on the program.
I so want to go. Don't you need an
assistant? No pastrami on this trip, though.
Okay. Well, without further ado, I'm going to turn it over
to Agnes. You up for craving pastrami when you get home.
Okay.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. I'm assuming that all of you like deli in one way or another. I thought I was going to come here tonight to argue with David, because what could he possibly know about delicatessen? He's too young. He's from Toronto. I just found out tonight he's only lived in New York for 2 years.
Not even.
He thinks L.A. has better pastrami than New York. I heard all this before I read the book. But now that I've read the book, I have to tell you that nobody else in the world, of course, has traveled from New York to L.A. and to Canada and back eating pastrami, corned beef, and what he calls deli foods. I just call food. But I have to defer to David as truly the greatest delicatessen expert in the world. And actually, he has a little apology in the front of the book about not having visited certain delicatessens, one of which I did go to, by the way.
Which
in
one?
Baltimore.
Oh.
But I never remember.
Atman's,
yeah. Right. So I haven't been to that many delis. I'm a real provincial. I only know about New York food. But David knows about everything. So first, why should we bother to save the deli?
Well, you know, I always say for two reasons. The first reason is taste. With the exception of the Arthur Schwartz team of the world, a lot of people, especially of younger generations of Jews, don't know how to cook. And if the Jewish delicatessens aren't serving this food, if a place like the Second Avenue Deli isn't making pachah, no one else will. And for people who don't have a connection to this food or don't know how to make it themselves or just come to New York as, you know, a nice Gentile boy from the Midwest and want to taste what matzo ball soup tastes like, if the Jewish delicatessens aren't around to serve that food, no one else will. We can't.
They can come to my house.
They could come to your house, but you would get pretty sick of that after a while, I think.
I know I would.
And, you know, we can't leave it up to the TGI Fridays and the Subways and the Momofukus.
Right, but why is this food important? I mean, can't the world live without matzo balls?
I suppose. No.
Maybe we can't in this room. Actually, I picked a bad example because matzo balls are now a tourist attraction in New York. People actually come to New York and they seek out a bowl. They call it matzo ball soup, which irritates me. It's chicken soup with matzo balls because you can have other things in the chicken soup besides matzo balls. For instance, kreplach have died out. Speaking of dying foods. But
right.
Really, why? I mean, I'm going to be the devil's advocate here.
Sure.
I'm on a diet. I can't eat pastrami. No, truthfully. And when I do allow myself, when I'm not on a diet, to eat pastrami, I go to Katz's. And it's enough, you know? And I do it maybe once every 4 or 5 months at the most. which is, of course, why the delis are dying to begin with, because people like me don't eat deli every week the way we did 40 years ago. But this is food that's not so healthy. I mean, let's face it. It's full of salt. You don't want to eat lean pastrami. You don't want to eat lean corned beef. So why should we... There are cultural reasons, I think, that we should need to save this food.
Okay, so let's tackle the health reason. Everyone says, oh, it's dying out because people are so healthy. They're so healthy these days. You look around the city, and the most popular foods and restaurants that are opening are meatball places, southern barbecue places, fried chicken places.
Back fat.
America is fatter than it ever was.
True.
So I think everyone's saying, oh, wait, you know, wait, we're not going to delis because we're so healthy, is, with the exception of the dieting few.
We eat it less frequently, even those of us who allow ourselves to eat it.
But I think you're right. The cultural reason is more relevant. And that's because, you know, the generation that founded these types of restaurants and opened them were the people who came through Ellis Island and came here and came from those countries, from Yiddish Eastern Europe, where this was the food that they ate on a daily basis. There was, you know, there was no Chinese food in Poland, which is why they left. That was one of the reasons. Nothing to do with the Nazis. And the thing is that, you know, with each generation that's successively grown up here in the United States or in other countries, their connection to that food is diminished. So you're saying, well, you know, if they're all going and eating, you know, Japanese food or Chinese food or Thai food or Italian food or whatever, then why don't we just get rid of it? Why don't we abandon it? But it is a part of our history, and food is one of the things that ties us to who we are and where
we
came from.
It
tells a story, right?
Yeah.
And there's a famous saying, which I think it was Cesar Chavez who said, you know, the first thing that's going to go for us is our language. And the next thing that's going to go as we sort of absorb is religion. And the final thing to go is food, that somebody could be ethnically Jewish but have never gone to a synagogue in their life and married out of the faith and doesn't speak a word of Hebrew or Yiddish, but they still eat bagels. They still eat knishes. And it
makes them feel Jewish.
It makes them feel Jewish.
To eat a bagel.
Right.
And David's absolutely right. The last thing to go is food. You lose your language. You lose a lot of other traditions. And you don't lose the food. So if you're Italian-American, you know you're Italian-American because you get lasagna on Thanksgiving. Before the turkey, there's a lasagna. Last night I went to a panel on Chinese food, and they know they're Chinese because there are certain dishes that they grew up with, even though these were four Americans on the panel, certain dishes that they associate with their Chinese culture.
Exactly. And also, you know, beyond the food, I mean, the institution of the delicatessen isn't just a place to go and pick up a sandwich. When you go and have a meal at a Jewish deli, you're getting an accessible, authentic Jewish experience that you don't get anywhere else.
Well, right? I would quibble with that. I mean, they have Korean servers at the stage deli.
It doesn't, I mean,
for a pickle, they look at you like, eh.
But, you know, the Korean kimchi? And the Chinese waitresses, I mean, they speak as though they're the old Jewish waiters.
Yeah.
They still have that same pitter-patter. You know, you can go into a Jewish delicatessen and it almost feels like you're at the table of your Aunt Zelda, the way people are behaving, the pitter-patter of sort of
I want to know where you're going, David, because I'm not having that experience. I'm going to Lloyd's and what's his name?
Jay and Lloyd's
and Edelman's and, you know, no, Mill Basin Deli is terrible, but we'll get to that later. Is the owner here?
I don't see it.
Well, you know, truthfully, it's terrible. And I'm sorry. The owner sent me there. He said, you know, I'd like your input because we're having some problems. So I went with some friends. We ordered a lot of food. I didn't know that I was being videotaped. So the next day, the owner knew exactly what I thought, too. I was going to be a little more gentle on the phone. In any case, I'm not having that deli experience, David. I'm not having that old-time feeling of being in the... in a Jewish cocoon, cultural cocoon.
I don't think it's an old-time experience. I mean, I just think it's the idea that you're amongst your people. There aren't any other Jewish types of restaurants. I mean, there are Israeli restaurants, but when you go into one of those places...
There are fancy Jewish restaurants.
There are fancy Jewish restaurants where they try to do everything to remove the Jewishness of the experience.
Well, I always say if a kosher Martian landed in New York, he would think sushi was the most Jewish food. Because you go to Prime Grill, this kosher steakhouse, all the boys, and they don't wear yarmulkes anymore. They wear baseball caps, and they're all eating sushi as if it's not an appetizer in a Jewish restaurant. It's not the main course.
It's appetizing.
It's appetizing.
The schmear.
No,
on
it's
the side.
It's the vorspeise. You know, like, and then you know after you've had 12 pieces of sushi, then you go on to your prime steak. You know,
yeah, your $58
right
6 ounce T-bone or something like
right.
that.
Right. And I wish I could get that experience. The only place I go where I feel like I'm among my people, but they don't think I'm one of the people, used to be the Crown Delicatessen. That's on 13th Avenue in Borough Park. And they're Hungarian Jews and a Polish cook in the kitchen.
I mean,
and they're like mamas who want you to enjoy
your food. But I'll put it this
way.
If you found yourself in New Orleans, Louisiana, and you were kosher, or you just found yourself there and it was, you know, a Sunday morning and you've been doing a project at a Presbyterian church all day or something like that, you know that you can go to the kosher Cajun delicatessen, and even though you're sitting there in the middle of New Orleans and the people have Southern accents, it has that same feel. There's a certain sound, there's a certain smell, there's a certain taste that links you to a greater story.
So this makes me think of the customers. I do go to Jewish delicatessens, and what's the name of the one in Baltimore again?
Atman's.
Atman's. It struck me that at lunchtime at Atman's, the line, which was out the front door, was all African American. There was not a Jew on the line. I knew that the big market for sweet kosher wine is the African American community, no longer the Jewish community. And apparently, according to David, it's the same with delicatessen.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, a lot of the communities where which sort of changed from dense Jewish areas to mostly African American inner cities, like Corned Beef Row,
Baltimore,
Detroit, Newark. The delicatessens that remained, so let's say there were, you know, a couple dozen delis, well, a lot of them just left with the Jews. They were the whites that fled. But the few delis that did remain and said, you know what, this is a clientele that we can serve, have actually done really well. And in many cases, the delis adapted to change the role. So, you know, none of them are kosher because, no, you know, if you're serving, I don't know, 90% African-American clientele, you're not going to have anyone who's kosher. And it's very much geared towards, you know, thrift and like sort of
it's
larger,
also true that
cheaper
you can get better meat for pastrami and corned beef, non-kosher, than kosher.
Yeah, that's a whole other kettle of fish.
Well, I thought we should talk about that tonight.
But I think
quality, you know, is a problem in delicatessen.
You know, it's like you don't have to be Jewish to love Levy's rye bread. You don't have to be Jewish to love the Jewish delicatessen. And I think a lot of people are like, oh, you know, it's a shame because, you know, I went into the deli and it was, you know, a Chinese waitress and it was all African-American customers. And, oh, it's really gone downhill. But the fact of the matter is that's the best thing that could happen. Because if it was only Jews eating there, all these places would be closed.
Yeah. Tell them the example of Florida, where you thought you were going to find the wellspring of delicatessen.
I did. I mean, I thought it was, you know, I thought South Florida, it's the third largest Jewish area in the country outside of New York and Los Angeles, and I thought it would have tremendous amounts of fantastic delis. And it does have a good number of them, but they're certainly not the best that I'd had anywhere. I mean, I was kind of underwhelmed. And the last great one, I sort of saw it close before my eyes, the Rascal House, which I'm sure a few of you might have.
Yeah, I went just in its death throes.
Exactly, yeah.
At the end there. But to me, that was not a delicatessen.
Wolfie Cohen's Rascal House.
Wolfie's closed first, and then Rascal House, which was further up. I never got to Wolfie's, and I always wanted to find out, never was able to, if the Wolfie's in Florida was any relation to the Wolfie's in Brooklyn. I don't know, anybody remembers Wolfie's on Nostrand Avenue near Brooklyn College. One of my favorite places as a kid. But to me, those were not delicatessens. Those were sort of in the order of a diner, a family restaurant that had sort of everything on the menu. I mean, you could get a tuna fish sandwich, too.
Well, the delicatessen, I mean, the thing is it evolved, right? So when it first came to these shores in the 1880s, 1890s, in the, you know, lower Manhattan, Lower East Side, downtown, what's now Chinatown, it was a very small, Spartan, basic thing. It was basically a butcher shop that sold cured meats and sausages and salamis. in the style of the different countries. So you would have, you know, your Ukrainian kosher delicatessen and your Polish kosher delicatessen and your, you know, whatever.
I think they all started as German.
Originally,
really,
yeah.
Originally.
It, you know, it was all
hot
when immigrants
came in. Hot dogs and salami
are
German.
But it evolved.
German.
Like, it evolved in a couple of years. So as people, as the Jews down in New York got more affluent, their offerings expanded. It turned more into a small sort of takeout place and then a little sit-down place
and then
a diner.
I think, you know, sometimes your history is a little sketchy.
okay.
Actually,
you're the expert.
I think delicatessens evolved into. You're right in that they first started out just serving probably just some sliced meats and sandwiches and pickles and for working people. Jews upwardly mobile were working their asses off to get out of the slums of the Lower East Side. But they also were a lot of men working here, without families, and also they became places where these men could meet each other. You know, they were meeting places. And they were feeding people who didn't really have homes because the wives and children were still back in the old country. They were waiting to establish themselves here before they brought the families over. So you're right. And then supposedly pastrami was not introduced into the delicatessen until I think it was 1888 is the year that, yeah, we both necessarily believe
no
this
plaque.
Story.
There's
What's
no plaque
name?
On the ground. Oh,
no, there's a woman here in New York whose father... family, the whole family were in the restaurant business, and she claims that her grandfather, Sussman Volk, stuffed Patricia, thank you. Are you Patricia? No. I've never met Patricia, but we've talked on the phone. The book is called Stuffed. It's a really good read, too. And she claims that her grandfather, who was Alsatian.
I think he was Lithuanian. He was Lithuanian.
In any case, some guy came in to him and said, sell my pastrami.
Right.
And he said, okay, I'll give it a try. And that was the first pastrami. Until then, I guess corned beef was the
Well,
meat
I mean,
of choice,
like you said, the first group of, you know, major East European Jews who came and settled here were the Germans, who came in the 1850s. But they were largely urban and a little more educated and wealthier.
Absolutely.
And they sold their types of things. They sold, you know, sausages and
and
those sorts of things. And you know, pastrami is a Romanian level of, it's a Romanian method of curing and spicing. The Romanians do it with, I think, mutton and often
and
pork.
Beef.
And beef as well. Mm-hmm. And the Jews in sort of Eastern Europe were, the Romanian Jews were mostly applying this method of curing something with pepper and spice, and then smoking it, mostly with geese and ducks and chicken, because beef just wasn't something that was readily available for most of them. But here, the taste changed, right? You don't see a lot of places that serve geese or duck. Hell, you don't see any. But a lot of them serve beef. That's the American thing, because we could grow beef on the plains here. We could bring it in by train. It was a lot easier. And so that method of spicing got applied to...
Well, the original product is something called basterma, B-A-S-T-E-R-M-A in English. And basterma is from the Ottomans, from Turkey. And they of course, the Ottoman Empire extended into Hungary and Romania. And a lot of our Hungarian and Romanian food, a lot of Jewish food we owe to the Ottomans. Stuffed cabbage, Ottoman concept, all the stuffed vegetable things. I can name other things, but not at this moment. But all these things did come together at some point as delicatessen food, but I think it came in your generation, because when I was a kid, most delicatessens didn't sell all these prepared foods. It came little by little. I don't know when we'll hear from you later if you have, remember, my family never would have dreamt of getting stuffed cabbage from a delicatessen or kasha varnishkas from a delicatessen. These were things you made at home. You didn't buy them. And I think in the 1950s and 60s, when more women were trying to get out of the kitchen, let's just summarize it by saying that, in many different ways, Jewish women could go to a delicatessen and buy these prepared foods before Gentile women could go to the supermarket or a takeout shop and buy prepared foods. We were early, you know, we invented prepared foods. let's talk a little bit about the quality of the actual products, because this is my issue with delis these days, and why I sometimes say, after I've left a deli, this place is not worth being saved. Let's start with pastrami. Now, the real, I want you to do the talking here, the real cut of, for pastrami is not brisket.
Right, New York pastrami, which is, you know, what I said, that sort of Romanian spicing that got famous here, can be made with brisket, but traditionally it's made with a cut of beef called the navel. So if the brisket is the breast of the cattle, the navel is the belly. It's like the bacon of
the
beef.
The bacon.
It goes, it's underneath the short ribs, the flank, and it's you know, a very tough, with a sort of really thick fatty cap on it, and it's wonderful. So the way it's prepared, traditionally, is you'll take a rub of salt, garlic, coriander, black pepper, and sort of brown sugar, and you'll rub it on this meat, and you'll let that cure for anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks to longer. And then you'll put that in a smoker, and you'll smoke it for a couple of hours, and then sort of steam it and slice it, and voila, it's delicious. What happened in the early in the 20th century and really up in the 1950s, is that that takes a lot of time. You need like barrels and barrels of meat to slowly cure. It's very hard to control. Some things can sort of, some ones will cure faster than others, so you have problems with consistency. And so what happened was these deli owners said, well, if there's a way to do this cheaper and better, we should do it. And so companies like Hebrew National and Isaac Gellis came along and started making pastrami for the delicatessens. And then they started getting preservatives like nitrates and phosphates and these sorts of things, which allowed them to cure the meat in 2 days instead of over a week. And it was cheaper and easier. And now what happens is you basically, with corned beef as well, the meat is on a conveyor belt and there's this big machine called an injector machine. And it has this whole like grid of 50 hypodermic needles that plunge down into the meat and inject it with all the pickling spice and then go up. And so instead of it slowly curing, it's injected really quickly in this crazy thing that looks like an airport X-ray machine from hell, and then sort of smoked and steamed. And, you know, the same thing has happened with rye bread, right? Once you would get rye bread from a small baker, it had 30, 40% rye flour in it. It had a very tangy, yeasty aroma and thick texture. And white flour became much cheaper and much more appealing to people. It lasted longer because it had more preservatives in it, and bakeries were able to just sort of churn the loaves of rye bread out. I mean, I hate to say it, but New York has the worst rye bread of any city I've visited besides London, England.
That's saying
something. London is really bad. London's white bread with seeds in it. But, you know, everyone's like, well, what isn't like it used to be?
So where do we have to go to get good rye bread? You're going to tell me L.A., I know.
Well, Detroit. Detroit has the best rye bread I've tasted. But in the more general topic of, you know, what happened.
Can we mail order it?
Yeah, you can mail order it from Zingerman's Bakery in Ann Arbor, Michigan. What happened to deli food is what happened to a lot of food in America, which is that price trumped quality. And people looked at the bottom line, but they sort of forgot about taste. And they're like, well, you know, if I can get this brisket or this corned beef for $5 a pound less, well, I can charge that much more. Or
so who's making good pastrami and who's making good? Let's start in New York, okay? Because I'm not going to Detroit.
Ever.
At least, no, I've been to Detroit. I did it already. If Aretha invites me home for dinner, I'll go to Detroit. Who has good meat here in New York?
I mean, there are still places that are doing it really well, right? Katz's still does it really well. Sometimes you're going to get a sandwich that's better than others just because some woman in the back is like...
No, I know. There are people who hate Katz's. Raise your hand if you hate Katz's. Okay. I want to hear from you later. I want to know why.
So, you know, one of the reasons why I think Katz's is still great and probably the best pastrami in New York is because they're the only ones that hand slice it.
But also they have specs for the meat. I mean, they have the meat specially made for them, and they do follow.
Yeah, they have their
brisket,
recipe.
It's navel.
It's navel, but you know, hand slicing. The difference between hand slicing and machine cutting is you can steam the meat longer if you're going to hand slice it. Because if you put really, really, really super tender meat on a machine, it's just going to break apart. You're not going to get slices.
On the other hand, if you slice slightly chewy meat, very, very thin, it seems tender.
Right, but it's masking it almost. So that's why I think it's good. And also, you know, a cutter who's skilled can cut out those little pieces of sinew and fiber that are going to give you that, you know, when you bite in and then like the whole sandwich just
rips
apart. He
worked at Katz's one night to see what this was all about.
Right.
It's maybe the best chapter in the book.
Yeah, and I'm sure the people who didn't like it were the people who ate my sandwiches that night. I know yeah, that guy.
He made your sandwich, right. So if I want a pastrami sandwich, I go to Katz's.
You can go to Katz's.
Where else can I go?
You can go to...
And the bread is not very good.
The bread, all the delis in New York except two or three use the bread from this one large company in New Jersey, which is all the... It's just, you know, it's that crappy rye that I was telling you about.
Abe Liebewohl of the Blessed Memory used to tell me that he had one bakery that he could get good rye bread from. And you had to get to the deli between 12 and 2 if you wanted to get the good rye bread.
Those loaves.
Because the good bread was gone by 2 o'clock. So if you came in after 2, sorry. But
saving it for the lunch.
But the dirty secret of the Second Avenue Deli is that their meat was never very good. I shouldn't say never. In the last years of the Second Avenue Deli, I don't count the new one, the last years even during Abe's reign, if he wanted a good pastrami sandwich, he went to Katz's.
Everyone's got their opinions out there. So, you know, one of the interesting things, a place that's really interesting, which is sort of, I think, hopefully a bit of a game changer, is this new place in Brooklyn that opened up about 2 months ago called Mile End.
Where is it?
It's in Borum Hill. It's in a tiny place that's about three times the size of the stage. And it's a young couple. He's from Montreal. She's from New Jersey. Lovely Jewish kids, both recently married. And what he's done is he's opened up a Montreal-style delicatessen, which is, you know, smoked meat, which is like the bastard child of corned beef and pastrami. But what he's doing is he's curing the meat himself. So instead of getting it from a company that injects it, he's curing it in barrels slowly over time. And, you know, that has its own problems. Like the first month, they would close down at 1 o'clock, 1:30 every day because they would sell out of meat. They would run out of it, and it takes 10 days to cure it. And he's putting his stuff on Orwasher's rye bread, which is an old-school Jewish bakery in the Upper East Side, and he's sort of taking the efforts to do that. So what I hope we'll see, and I've seen in bits and pieces
it's
around the country.
It's just a sandwich shop?
He has a couple of other things as well.
But, I mean, can you eat in?
Yeah.
Big enough for me to fit?
There's like 20, you know, Brooklyn hipster size seats, and then like, I don't know, 15 Arthur Schwartz size.
Okay.
I mean, it's very, very cramped.
Yeah.
I sat
actually,
at the table.
I was the stool tester for a hipster lounge.
That doesn't sound right at all, by the way.
No, I'm telling you, I'm walking out of this restaurant, and this guy says to me, this is a true story. The guy comes out, he's like 20-something. He says, would you come test my bar stools? I said, I'll do it for you, but I don't think I'm your typical customer, you know? He said, well, we have two different kinds of stools, and I want to know which one is more comfortable, the one with the back or the one without the back. I said, well, with my backside, I need the one without the back so I can hang over. Hipsters are very little.
I don't know, yeah. And all they do is eat, like, mac and cheese and barbecue and drink beer. Must be the drugs. So that place is really interesting, and there's a couple places throughout the country that are starting to do it, whereas, you know, what you're seeing in the rest of the food...
We're talking about artisanal delicatessen.
Yeah, or just stuff, I mean, without getting too fancy about it, it's stuff that's made from scratch. It's places that are going back to the very roots of this cuisine and cracking open the Arthur Schwartz cookbook, and it's like, you know what, instead of getting this stuff from Sysco or Hebrew National or another company, we're going to do this ourselves. And one, I think it generally tastes better. And two, it gives them something unique. So if Second Avenue Deli, Ben's Best
Carnegie, in Queens.
Yeah, Ben's Best in Queens.
It's
Edelman's.
Where Lou G. Siegel used to be.
Anyway, you know, the thing is, if every single deli, like Ubet's Chocolate Syrup. So there's this deli in Portland, Oregon. And it's called Kenny and Zooks, and it opened up a couple years ago, and it's really good. They're making all their stuff from scratch, and it's quite delicious. Don't worry, the owner's a New York Jew, so it's bona fide. But when they opened up, they said, you know what, we want to make egg creams, but we're going to use Dagoba organic chocolate syrup instead of Ubet's. Hold on. Easy, Jews. Because he said, listen, one, Ubet's is a product which has no chocolate in it. You know, it's just like a chemical syrup type thing. It's cornstarch.
Terrible.
And two, this organic chocolate syrup is made from real cocoa, and it's going to taste better. How would the original people who were doing this back in, you know, 1901 have made this? Would they have made it with real chocolate, or would
they
have made
it
with some chemical
they.
Product?
It was they. A he.
It was a he? Okay. You know the history of the egg?
I certainly do.
I don't.
1905, Louis Auster, Lower East Side, nasty man. As most of these people, my grandfather, by the way, was always in the food business all his life, and he was a nasty waiter at the famous dairy restaurant on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn. In any case, Louis Auster made this secret syrup for me. He didn't use Fox's Use Bet. In fact, one theory of it being called the egg cream is because perhaps Louis actually had eggs and cream in the syrup that he made at the back of the store. Not even his sons were allowed to see what he was putting in the syrup. I interviewed his grandson, Stanley, who's significantly older than me, so I'm not sure Stanley's still alive. He lived in Riverdale at the time, and I called his house to ask him if he'd be on my radio show. He said, I can't talk about egg creams because I have a heart condition. And his wife said, from the background, I heard him say, Stanley, stop talking about yourself. Talk about egg creams. You'll feel better. So Stanley was on my show. Stanley says, yes, I think my grandfather did, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, Louis Auster ended up opening up three more luncheonette fountains for each of his sons. And the last one still exists. It's the Gem Spa on the corner of St. Mark's and 2nd Avenue. And even though that's owned by Pakistanis now, they still make egg creams there. And it's the same store, yeah.
But is it the same syrup?
No, they probably use... See, now this offends me. A delicatessen, a Jewish delicatessen, even though it may not be kosher, should be kosher style. And what are they doing serving egg creams, a dairy product? And, you know, it's like I stopped going to the Carnegie when they started serving shrimp salad.
It's funny, there is this bounds of what's acceptable. And this place in Oregon, you know, they were saying that they had this big fight. So they serve Reuben sandwiches, which, you know, has cheese on the meat. And they're like, listen, we got to do it. This is our big thing. But the two owners got in a huge fight over whether to serve bacon with their breakfast specials. And one of the owners is like, well, if we're doing the, you know, egg creams and the Reubens, what's the difference? And the other one's like, there are certain things that I will do, and there are certain things that I won't.
I just had a student in Italy with me. He wouldn't eat pork sausage, but he would eat bacon.
Right. Know? Bacon is, yeah.
That or was his... You know.
So, yeah, I mean, the sliding scale of what's right. acceptable in the kosher style. Is that our five-minute warning?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I do think that they have a problem here. Reubens, by the way, are not a Jewish deli item. Reubens were invented by a shiksa, a waitress at a hotel in Omaha. I forget if it's Omaha, Nebraska, or it's something like North Dakota. You know, I'm a Brooklyn boy. It's all the same to me. It's the north and the middle. And it was this Polish-Jewish resident who had a poker game once a week at the hotel, and he made this sandwich for his buddies. His name was Reuben, and he made this sandwich. And the waitress who used to serve the sandwiches in the early 1950s entered the sandwich in the National Sandwich Contest. And that's how it became popular.
But it was a Polish Jew who invented it.
A Polish Jew invented it, but he was living in Omaha. What did he know from kosher food, you know? It was the National Wheat Council, which I was a food editor. They still existed, and they had this National Sandwich Contest. The Reubens Delicatessen in New York, old man Reuben, who was another nasty man, Arnold Reuben, once it became popular, he claimed, it's actually was his son who claimed it was their sandwich. But I have many menus from Reuben's. It was never, ever on the menu at Reuben's. And Reuben's listed, you know, 25, 30 sandwiches. So they always named them after different people. And one woman came in, a Broadway starlet, came in and she ordered this sandwich, which may have been something like a Reuben. And she said to Mr. Reuben, would you name it after me? And he said, like hell I will. And he named it a Reuben, Reuben Special. But the Reuben Special is not the Reuben sandwich. It's totally different. It's like turkey and chopped liver with roast beef.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, thank you guys so much. We're going to be outside so you can ask us questions once we get out.